This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak today. And we will have council this afternoon at 12:30. So I know many of you will attend, and I hope that some of you maybe who haven't attended will attend. So before I talk officially, I'd like to be completely self-serving and just take a moment for that. Let you know that I have upstairs brought 4 small jars of honey from my backyard beehive. And it's definitely a micro organization, but I started a little sitting group in San Mateo that I originally called Peninsula Zen. And it was me sitting at a yoga studio every week. And then one more person joined me, and then one more person joined me sitting. And then it was 3 of us sitting for quite a few months. And now I decided to bring zabutons to the studio, even though it's quite an effort. I have to haul them from my home, and you know, every week. It's kind of a big deal. And I was also carrying hot water and tea and all this stuff so people could be there. And I decided to start to bring zabutons and zafus. And suddenly we now have 8 to 10 people coming every week. I can't explain this except that they want to sit and they want to, learn about posture. They're very interested in posture, really interesting to me. So we need zabutons. We need more zabutons. So I am selling the honey or asking for donations for these little jars of honey in order to buy zabutons for my sitting group. So if you're interested, they're in a little box up there on the table. Feel free to make a donation and take a jar. We're asking $20 because, believe me, to get this honey, I had to get chased out of the beehive one time. My eye, and I got a sting here and a sting here, and I was so tired I went to sleep, and when I woke up, all I could see was, something over my eye. My eye had swollen. I mean, they didn't love me at first, but I harvested them again about a month later, and they were much calmer. So this comes from the second attempt. I didn't get stung at all. But anyway, it's just raw honey right out of the hive, and it's very lovely if you're interested. So I wanted to talk today about Emperor Wu, because I just have such affection for Emperor Wu. And because I think that Emperor Wu actually taught us so much. And we focus on Bodhidharma, and I think we miss the teaching that Emperor Wu, sometimes we miss the teaching that Emperor Wu actually left behind. So I want to, quote his comments on learning of the death of Bodhidharma. He said, "Alas, I saw him without seeing him. I met him without meeting him. I encountered him without encountering him. Now, as before, I regret this deeply." And I think of this phrase, this commentary by Emperor Wu, whenever I feel it, regret at not having really known someone, at perhaps having admired someone, but never taken the time because I had to run off or I had to, whatever was I thought was important in the moment, took away that opportunity to really meet, you know. I wonder if you've ever had that kind of experience, felt that way? Yeah. I think it's kind of common in our society where the real, where sort of the values are speed and acquisition, and then we, you know, acquisition of experiences, acquisition of doing, acquisition of things, and then so we don't sometimes pause and really meet even our own experience, even the experience of acquiring. We don't meet it fully and breathe it in and let it be part of us. So we just have to move on to the next acquisition, to keep trying to feed something. But I think we are missing each other in this process. So do we see one another really seeing? You know, most of the time I see myself. That's what I see. I look at you, I see me. I see you through the lens of Beata. And Beata's needs and Beata's interests and what Beata has to do next, and you know, and essentially kind of overlooking you, even while I'm seeing you. I may remember what you look like, but did I really see you? I think in this, you know, rush of our everyday lives, we're just so used to looking without seeing. Things that rush by us, you know, we look without seeing. And in this culture, I think we put more value on a good use of time. And a good use of time means time that produces something, right? But is it an equally good use of time to just pause and look at another person and really see them as they are? Just be willing to let, to be affected by another person. I mean, I think we all looked at Robin Williams without seeing him, you know? And that's very, very deep learning from his death that we can kind of take too. You know, we gauge the value of the moment by what was accomplished. And it is not considered an accomplishment to really meet another person or really see another person. So we meet a lot of people, but do we really meet them? Deeply meeting another. What is it to deeply meet another? I've experienced myself many times a meeting in which I was very moved, but maybe nothing was even said, but something was exchanged, some subtle connection was exchanged, and that can only happen in this tender allowing of time and proximity to one another. So I think we have this experience in Sesshin where we really meet other people without speaking. We might not know what they do for a living. We might not know where they live. We might not know their name. We sit with them for a weekend and we meet them. We know their footfall when they walk in the Zendo. We know what they suffer with. We know their physicality. How they get up, how nimble they are, how much pain they have in some cases, you know, especially in long sitting. So, you know, I think it's mostly wordless when I feel I've truly met someone. Or at least I can't describe what happened. I can't describe this meeting in words. I think I've said here before, my sister, who lives locally here, she often says to me, and she's very supportive of my practice, and you know, comes to every, you know, Jukai and every everything, you know, the talks and all sorts of things she's come to. And every time she says to me, "Why do you do this? Why do you do this? It seems crazy to me." In other words, you know, it just doesn't seem like a fit to her, for her life and even for my life. So I'm a very outgoing person. Why do you sit and look at a wall for 5 days? Why do you do that? I've struggled with Zazen. Zazen hasn't always been easy for me. Why do you do that? Well, for me, I do it because it allows me to encounter this spaciousness in which I can truly encounter and meet another human being without all the trappings, maybe without a name, without a job class, without a living, you know, without anything to define them, but just what I'm seeing in front of me. It's so deep to me and so moving to me that we give ourselves to one another in that way, in practice, that's why I do this. I don't have too many other experiences in my life, too many other things that go on every day in my life that bring that deep sense of meeting. I think deep meeting has a tinge of fear in it, and so we avoid it. And I've been encountering this with young people coming to my little sitting group who really want to talk to me, but they're scared. And I'm like, really? Why? But I think they have an idea that it might be a deep meeting. And it's a little like, will she see something I'm not meaning to show? Or I'm not sure what it is. It's interesting. I've experienced it, waiting in line for Dokusan or practice discussion, and experienced this fear, little twinge of fear, like, what will this be? Little uncertainty, little, you know, if I don't have a good question or something I think to be the centerpiece of the discussion, you know, then what will it be? And at times in my practice, I've forced myself to go with no idea and just cause myself to enter the room and bow and see and be seen. And those have been some of the deepest meetings with teachers, where I haven't tried to fill it in out of fear. And really, in a sense, in the conversation this meeting between Emperor Wu and Bodhidharma, Emperor Wu was anxious, I think, and he was trying to fill it in with words. Look, man, I do all this stuff, and I offer incense, and I build temples, and I support nuns and monks. You know, what merit do I receive for this? You know, he had a good question. For me, that would have been a way to manage my fear of the encounter, would have been to, you know, think up something to ask. And so I think deep meeting forces us, or in order to meet deeply, there needs to be a dropping of the self, a dropping of attachment to this little twinge of fear, and having to protect myself from this little twinge of fear. And if I notice the fear and just let it be, and go in with the fear and just let it be, open, open, soften, soften, then there's space for the other person to be seen. And I'm not just me-ing them. I'm actually able, or some part of me is actually able to meet on a beyond or underneath maybe all the what do you do, and you know, all the sort of surface stuff that we like to know about each other. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I think we need that too, but that's not the meeting that I think Emperor Wu regretted with Bodhidharma when he spoke, when Bodhidharma died. So to forget ourselves and be completely present to whatever may arise, it's a risky proposition in relationship because other people are unpredictable, I'm unpredictable. We don't know what that might be. It might even hurt. It might even be uncomfortable. It might even never get resolved, right? Or there's something might happen that might never get resolved. I mean, we don't know. So we just take that risk. But to me, that's a basic requirement for meeting deeply. So whether it feels good or hurts terribly, whether we understand or don't have a clue, the deep meeting is important. And maybe in that moment, we don't think it's so important, sort of like Emperor Wu, he didn't really know what to do with Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma came back at him, telling him, look, you're empty, man. But, you know, you're empty. Your offerings are empty. Your nuns and clerics are empty. You know, this whole thing is about emptiness. And that was not, I mean, in some ways you could say, well, where was Bodhidharma's compassion? Because he didn't meet Emperor Wu, in a sense, you know. And at the same time, somebody had to tell Emperor Wu that he was empty, that all these things he was doing weren't it. Otherwise, I mean, as a true Dharma friend, how would he ever find out what was it? How would he ever be moved to really work with himself, to really study himself instead of doing all these external things? So it was a compassionate response from that standpoint, but in the moment, it probably didn't feel that way to Emperor Wu. So I think we cannot meet deeply and be partial, you know, include ourselves partially. I think it requires the whole of us and the vulnerability that comes with that, the vulnerability in showing you everything. And I think that's really actually what Bodhidharma did. He sort of showed Emperor Wu everything. I don't know who this is. That's a pretty vulnerable thing to say to someone. Well, then who are you? And he says, I don't know. That's pretty, you know, standing nowhere of Bodhidharma. And for a great sage to basically say, you know, I don't know, was pretty vulnerable with the emperor standing there. So I think in a way, Bodhidharma showed up fully and Emperor Wu was kind of protecting some fear, maybe. I don't know, you know, this is all my projection because I never got to talk to either of them. But this, you know, this allowing to show our shame and our fear. I mean, for me, I had a lot of physical shame in practice because my body is different from a lot of bodies in most zendos. And I would think, oh, I'm just a bull in a china shop. I can't sit zazen because I'm, you know, it'd be hard to get up and this and that, and people will, you know, think, I mean, I just projected onto other people what they would think about me, and it caused shame. I had a lot of shame, and I thought, well, I just can't do it. But I kept going and just noticing that everyone experienced a certain shame about their bodies. And then that felt so sad to me, that we all bring our bodies to everything we do and yet experience a certain shame about them. And so that became something I started to talk about. Can we get past physical shame, shame of our bodies? Because our bodies are you know, our instrument. And they're no different from the very body of Shakyamuni Buddha. They are the same instrument that he had to attain realization. And regardless of how they look or how big or small they are or tall or short or what color they are or anything about them, they are the same body that Shakyamuni, the same instrument that Shakyamuni had and used. So, you know, bringing the whole enchilada and offering it to the meeting as it is, with all its pieces, I think that's what can bring real, deep, true meeting between people. Deep meeting is an enactment of the Bodhisattva vow to be where suffering is and allow ourselves to be affected by it and still open, soften, you know. Then there's this chance for this kind of understanding that is without words. So then Emperor Wu says, I encountered him without encountering him. So how often do we really encounter another? We encounter a lot of people walking here, driving here, you know, but they're chance encounters. They don't connect us. Maizumi Roshi, I started my practice in Southern California in Maizumi Roshi's lineage. And he used to say that you can only awaken in Sangha. He said, it's like boiling potatoes. You throw all the potatoes in the pot and they boil them and they bump up against each other and they get softer. He said, that's like Sangha practice. You know, we're all just these potatoes bumping up against each other and softening. He didn't say it would necessarily always feel good. But that through these deep, you know, these deep encounters with one another in Sangha, you know, we would ourselves learn and become softer. So a true encounter with something, whether it be the wall or Zazen or another person, can you describe it? I was really thinking about this, like, you could tell the story of it. Well, I met him and we talked and it was really great and I felt really moved. You know, you could use a lot of words, but when you walk away, do you think, well, I didn't quite get it. You know, I can't quite describe it in words. Because I think these are all experiences of emptiness. It's emptiness meeting emptiness. And so at the end, what's there to say? The deepest part of it can't be put into words. It's like calling a tree a tree. Well, that's just ridiculous. I mean, what does that mean? It so diminishes the actual tree. So I think of deep encounters in that way. Mere words really have difficulty touching it. But I think we experience it in our bodies, actually. It's a felt sense of depth and trueness in the meeting, or in the encounter. So it's just a treasure given and received without doing anything. It calls us to not know in advance. If I think I know you, then I can't encounter you as you are. So I have to drop that knowing and just be here with you now. It's not so easy to do. It's very gutsy to drop what we think we know of another and let them be and just receive that and be received in the same way. So we can't know in advance, and you know, we have to take the risk of vulnerability and presence without knowing what might happen. So to encounter another, be it, you know, a moment or another person or just this, as we say in Zen, invites us to stay with whatever happens and to let it in without expecting something different. So even if my encounter with you is uncomfortable or awkward, or I'm left feeling, you know, like something not pleasant, still it was real. It was an authentic encounter. I had an experience yesterday at work. There's this porter who does the, you know, they come in and empty the trash and kind of do the cleaning of the bathrooms and so on. So, you know, he came to me about a couple weeks ago saying that another person, a temporary staff member, had, you know, belittled him in, through her actions. And so I took that up and said, well, you know, that's really not okay. And I went and talked with my boss about it and came back to him and said, you know, it was just, she'll be leaving in a week and what have you, just kind of let him know that we thought it was important, but that it was temporary and it would, she would be leaving. And that he could just kind of stay away, not empty her trash and be, leave it alone for a week. And he was okay with that. But I had learned his name then, and I kind of knew who he was and felt somewhat of a connection to him. So yesterday we had, these people were leaving, it was their last day, and they'd been with us for a couple weeks helping us out with things. So there was a pizza and cupcakes, you know, for them, a little party thing. And so there was a cupcake left. So when he came in, I said from across the room, Nathan, you know, you want this cupcake? And I didn't hear his response, because he was across the room. He talks very, very quietly. And in my mind, I just assumed he would want it, right? So I projected onto him, yes, he wants this. So I waited until he came down to, with his big trash bin and what have you, to my, where I was. And I said, Nathan, you know, you want, you probably don't want this now. Where can I put it? And he pointed to the trash can and he said, you can put it there. Now, here I was, you know, trying to include him, wanting him to feel, you know, like part of us, right? And not less than, because I think that's kind of how he walks in the world. But I didn't see him. I didn't see him. I saw me. And I said, well, if I put it in there, you won't want to eat it. Well, duh, right? So I pushed further, right? Pushed a little further with my idea of him. And finally, he looked at me and he said, are you done? And it was beautiful. I immediately woke up and went, oh, thank you. You know, yes, I'm done. And, you know, so here was this man trying to be gentle with me, trying to let me down easy, give me a way out. And I just keep meeing him and really missed him. So I encountered him without encountering him. And later on my way home, when I'm kind of feeling, you know, a little sadness in myself over that, over having missed that, missed him, I realized what I had done. Oh, you know, he was actually giving me a way out gently. I rejected that. Continue, you know, I kind of realized all this. And now I realized, you know, just leave it alone. He's very shy, I think, and he doesn't want to be called across the office and to be, you know, made a scene of out in the general public area. And that's what I did. And I believed afterward, I started to think, you know, that was white privilege, right? I was acting and enacting white privilege, which was my assumption that of course he would want this and this whole interaction would be fine with him. But here he is, this African-American man who's very shy, I think, and very quiet, came to me with his concern couple weeks ago. And then I just took that as some kind of invitation, which it was not. And then I think he wants to be included. Well, what is that? What is that about? That's me, meeting. That's not him. So it really opened my eyes. How he handled it, I thought was really beautiful and really opened my eyes to my own behavior. So helpful. I mean, to me, that's what Sangha does. That's what Sangha does. It helps me see that I'm meing instead of seeing. And it was very helpful to me. It hurt. I didn't feel good. Now I really feel bad, you know. But that's part of it. That's part of it. And of course, you know, being me, meing that, allowed me to learn this. But, and next time I will, I hope, be able to actually see the other more clearly in situations like that. And, or, you know, in where I encounter people, to be inclusive of who they are in my responses to them. So I have to be, I have to let in what I'm actually seeing, even if it's not what I think should be happening, or, not to not want something different in that moment or in that exchange. So now, counsel. I want to talk a little bit about counsel. It is not a doing process. It is a meeting place. It can be boring for certain periods of time that can pass with nothing said or nothing much on on people's minds. But that's usually it gets boring because we are making assumptions about other people. And if we just stay with ourselves, with our own discomfort with the quiet or whatever it is, whatever is going on, or feeling vulnerable because we have something to say, we don't know how to say it, we're nervous, we'll say it wrong, we'll do harm, something, whatever is going on, to just stay with our own discomfort is a teaching of counsel. We are meeting known friends anew. And allowing people to be new, just like breath in Zazen, one after another, and each one different from the other, and each one new. If it turns out, if it turns so often, I mean, it can happen that counsel turns into doing out of our discomfort of just being together. So we decide we need to flip chart stuff, and we need to make to-do lists, and we all need to make commitments, and we need to have council be like, a quasi-board meeting and or a planning session, because we just need to use the time and what have you, people. I mean, this is a lot like conjuring up a great question because of the fear of the teacher, or the fear of the encounter. So I see counsel as, a chance to meet without any expectation or a particular expectation that one is right and the other is wrong, that there will be blame and defense against blame, doing and knowing, sets up performance in counsel and judgment and evaluation. And these are all discursive functions of the mind. And there's, again, nothing wrong with the discursive mind. But counsel isn't, that's not what we're doing in counsel. What we're doing in counsel is under that. It's about just this meeting, just this true encounter with one another, where it doesn't always feel great, but it's real. People are speaking what is true for them. So, I would say that discursive functions are not necessarily encouraging of the counsel process, nor of deep meeting with no regret. So, have you ever gotten together with someone and that you rarely get together with, and then you end up talking about the weather and their job ad nauseum and your job ad nauseum, and you leave and you go, wait, we only meet once a year, and we end up talking about that. So learning to say, is this what we really want to be talking about in our precious time together? That to me, counsel is, a place where we get to talk about things we don't talk about all the time with everyone. We can create a container where anything can be brought forth for the good of the whole. So counsel has no gaining idea. It is an encountering mode. It's open and soft-hearted. It is just being with completely. I don't want anything in particular. If something happens or something gets planned or something gets done, icing. I like icing, but that's not why we sat down there. So being willing to encounter the self in relationship to another, to encounter the self bouncing off another, right, in relationship to another. This is what we do in Sangha, with nothing to change or fix or improve, just this as it is, without particular merit or gain, no particular accomplishment or productivity value. to stay with it when it's most difficult. That is when the self encounters the self in relation to others. And that is the most difficult part. It's also the most authentic and beautiful part of really encountering and meeting and seeing without regret. So the self worries that it will explode and destroy everyone, or the self thinks that everyone has it wrong and it has to leave because obviously this isn't working, or the self thinks that, or gets scared and thinks, you know, it's not as good, or it feels vulnerable, or whatever the self does in relation to this situation is the teaching for us. It's you teaching you about the Dharma. So why waste time doing it? This is the question that gets asked. Why waste time doing it? And the same, by the way, is said of Zazen. Why do you people waste time doing that? You're just sitting around. And I would simply say, alas, I saw him without seeing him. I met him without meeting him. I encountered him without encountering him. Now, as before, I regret this deeply. Questions or comments?
I really appreciate your lecture and really relate to what you're saying about meeting people and or meeting your life and the openness, courage, and risk that it requires. I feel like that's definitely something I want to continue to do. But when you talked about the risk involved, I feel like, you know, a number of years ago, as I was working with this very practice, and it's very fulfilling because, like you said, you could go through your whole life without really meeting people, or and I can also really relate to the subtleness and intimacy that you can experience with people in sesshin. You know, when you aren't talking about your job or any of these things, it can be quite moving just being with people as they are, not having stories about them, but having an actual experience of, you know, how somebody kind of strikes you, you know, and you. But I think as far as the risk is involved in my own personal willingness to take that risk, I also got hurt really badly. And like literally I've been recovering from it for years. It's taken me years to get over the pain that I went through from getting hurt, from being willing to be vulnerable like that, and then getting hurt so badly and kind of having a rug pulled out from under me. And I'm, you know, still wondering, like, you know, like I want to protect myself, which I think is reasonable to a certain extent. I was watching a documentary about William S. Burroughs, and he was being interviewed, and he's saying basically that he didn't want to do that. He wasn't willing to put himself in that position anymore because of the terrible risk of getting hurt. Like, he was particularly talking about romantic relationships, but saying basically, like, he didn't want to go there. He did not want to go there as far as romantic relationships goes because of the terrific, or he was also just talking in general terms about vulnerability and openness, allowing yourself to be open. He says, mm-hmm. if you allow yourself to be open, you're also, you know, putting yourself in a very risky situation. You mm-hmm. can really get hurt. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, like, how do you think practitioners should navigate the risk and the potential hurt? And if they do get hurt, in that very courageous process of making yourself vulnerable, which I think is like more the true courage as opposed to, I don't know. Conquest or whatever, you know, some kind of like military aggression, you know, but the courage of vulnerability, like, how's a practitioner supposed to deal with that?
I think that's a great question, and I think it's very personal,
yeah,
partly.
Of course.
But I want to say that, you know, I think that there's, just like there's idiot compassion, there's idiot openness too. And I do believe that we, you know, there is a sort of dynamic tension between vulnerability and protection.
Yeah.
I don't want to just say, hey, you know, increase vulnerability without some sort of knowing that there's also protection. But how do I make the protection appropriate to this situation so that I'm just not always protecting and then digging out from behind my protection to see you, but I'm seeing you and receiving you wholly, including protection. Protection is part of what I hold, or part of my wholeness. But I also want to say that I think the key to this, to the working this particular dynamic between vulnerability and permission or protection, is stability of body. And that's where practice really is a great training ground for this. Because even when I'm hurt, I am the mountain. I can come here and sit my body, and I know how to bring myself back to this hurt, and to know. So sometimes impermanence takes a lot too long to do its thing, but I can trust that it will shift. It will be different at different moments and over time and so on. And so that to me is what the practitioner does. They come back to practice. They come back to stability. My teacher Darlene used to say, "You in Zazen, you know, you cannot receive the bullet and also dodge it. Right? You have to be upright and prepared to receive it, and allow your heart," she would say, "to be broken 100 times a minute, and have enough stability to receive that." She also said, "And allow it to flow right through you. That it is not about you. It is not yours." It's, and so I think again, another practice would be, you know, but I think in these deep relationships where we bring ourselves wholly and we really meet, it starts to feel very personal, and that's where the pain comes from. I mean, it's just when something goes wrong, it's so personal. And the person knew us so well that they could actually hurt us, you know. So I think just to not overprotect, but also to, you know, it's like in response to being cold, do you cut off your arms? I mean, you know, no. I mean, you don't try to, you know, that wouldn't be a good answer to that. And so we still want to live rich lives and have these encounters. So I think honoring the hurt, allowing it, and also allowing it to move, because all things move and change, and not make the hurt solid, personal, and like you're solid, which you're not, and then not make the other person solid, which we know they're not. So that's how I work with it. But I think there's a good deal of just sitting in the hurt and realizing, yes, I'm feeling very hurt. And right, and you know, that's the truth of this situation for me.
I appreciate your response a lot. I mean, particularly too, how you, when you, what you said about, I mean, I was wondering if I should even ask you, because it is very personal. I realize that, and that's the first thing you said. It's not like you can tell me how to handle
right.
it. But still, I think what you said is quite helpful. And it seems to me even that, like, your Darlene's advice to you, in its own kind of way, it is kind of protection, if at least you're ready for it.
Yes, that's right.
As opposed to, the thing is, if you're kind of, you can protect yourself, like William S. Burroughs is saying, and that's a choice, you know, but you're cutting yourself off from a lot of things, then yeah, maybe you'll be leaving yourself safe from that kind of excruciating pain. Mm-hmm. But being prepared is another, I don't know, of course, it's personal. Like, you couldn't tell somebody else how.
Mm-hmm.
But the protection. I mean, thinking that like vulnerability and protection are mutually exclusive. I think that's problematic, and mm-hmm. I appreciated you kind of addressing that. But it is scary. You know, like mm-hmm. you talk about you know, meeting people, but it can be so intoxicating too.
Right, and that's the thing. That's the thing about it, is that if we allow ourselves to be dragged around, either by the high of the encounter that feels good, or by the low of the hurt that hurts, then we're not in it.
Yeah.
We're being dragged around by the highs and lows. And that's, you know, that's unpleasant, to say the least, you know.
Yeah.
So it's somehow that stability is not there of, you know, the stability of the base of the mountain, you know, and all the wind is blowing and the hikers are throwing their gum wrappers on the mountaintop and everything's happening there, but you're just, you know, and then all that can be going on. And it can, and there's enough stability to have that happen without doing that harm. So I would say in those times, returning to the stability. Yeah.
It's getting a little late.
Okay. One more.
Oh, it's not short. So I'll save it for after.
Are we going to run into council? Is it? Okay. Anybody have a short one? Okay.